Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Brotfeld, and Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Zoom edition of the Court of Appeals for this October 18 calendar. Apologies to counsel for holding you up. There were some technical difficulties on our end, and by our, I mean my end. Somehow I wasn't connecting, and so I apologize for the delay in the start. So you will have the full amount of time, however, for your argument. The first case on our calendar this morning, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, is it Duoth v. Wood? Counsel, you can correct me with my mispronunciation in a few moments when you begin your argument. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel to use if you'd like to for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, even though we're processing this by Zoom. We'll be keeping an audio recording, and this way we can keep track of who's attached to which argument. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Attorney Jacob Burkholz, and I really am not sure how to pronounce my client's name or not. I think it's Duoth, and he is the trustee and next of kin and the father of the decedent, Tavon Turek. Again, not 100% sure on the pronunciations, but either way, I think we'll follow the common ordinary understanding of their names. This is an appeal and requesting a reverse and remand to the district court's order in which it granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant, Mr. Stephen Wood. This arises, I don't think, well, there are significant factual disputes. I'll try and cover what I believe to be the errors, but overarchingly, there is a factual dispute which needs to go to a jury. And those factual disputes, just to summarize, is the location of this vehicle accident. I don't want to belabor the factual history, but essentially, it is Mr. Wood striking Mr. Turek, killing him. And that's the basic fact pattern. It is 50 miles an hour, give or take. Maybe he had a drink in his system by his own admission and is driving his son and I think his daughter-in-law in the vehicle, picked him up from the bar driving home. It is relatively dark, although again, factual dispute, we don't know exactly how dark. And somewhere on the edge of the roadway is Mr. Turek. We believe that the facts, the disputed facts, I know because the defense disputes them, is exactly where he's located. I believe there's significant evidence he may have been over on the shoulder entirely, or was he on the line or not. There is the roadway appears to be, for the most part, and this is a little disputed or unclear perhaps from the record, but the roadway itself, meaning between the lines, appears to be fairly clear, and then perhaps a little bit of snow on the shoulder, of course, from the traffic patterns that wear away the little bit of snow. But in any event, and where things begin to be disputed is because after the striking of Mr. Wood and killing Mr. Turek, his body is then on the roadway and gets pulled off by Mr. Wood or his son, in their belief, to the shoulder. And at that point, law enforcement, ambulance, emergency personnel.
Oh, counsel, if I may, and I apologize, you're giving a helpful narrative, but I just want to let you know that the panel has read the record in the case, and we're aware of the basic facts of this accident. So if you could, it seems to me you have started, you know, directly dealing with the district court's decision. Yep. And the district court, as I read the memoranda, and please correct me if you think it reads otherwise, district court found that there is no record evidence that Mr. Turek was on the shoulder, right? First of all, it sounds like you disagree with that. So would you help me out and let the panel know what you see as the record evidence from which we can infer, I assume, infer that Mr. Tarek was on the shoulder at the time of impact?
That starts with trying to spend most of my brief focus on that issue, because it certainly seems, but I want to make one additional comment perhaps before I get to that, and that is the district court's an additional layer of error here seems to be that the district court's requiring or suggesting a requirement of expert testimony, which I don't believe is required under Minnesota law, because that's where this.
And so I do think that's a really interesting issue, and I don't mean to, you know, belay to take your argument in a direction you don't want to go. But if you would, before you get to that one, if you would talk about what your record evidence is, the plaintiff's record evidence in support of Mr. Tarek being on the shoulder, and then, I mean, if I'm guiding you, I would love to know whether that. If we disagree with you that there is no record evidence from which we can infer that Mr. Tarek was on the shoulder, do you lose? I mean, those are my two questions. And if you want to take this and focus on the expert testimony issue, go right ahead. But I just want you to know those are the two concerns I have.
Well, I never want to avoid the panel's direct questions. That's, I don't think any ever helpful for an appellant. So page 5 of my brief, crash report by Deputy Dean Lang indicates footprints on the shoulder of the roadway. I think, you know, that's direct evidence from the crash report.
Here's my trouble. Lang's report is not admissible evidence, right? So you're really relying on Lang's deposition testimony, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I just want to make sure I was right about that. Right. And then the second thing is Lang's deposition testimony. Boy, you know, went, it took quite a different direction, didn't it, from his report? And I know you've laid out in your brief how you or your the plaintiff's attorney, I forget if it was you personally, but there was cross-examination of Lang to suggest that perhaps he didn't have a basis for saying the footprints were inside the travel lane, you know, which he clearly states in his deposition. So I realize you're going to cross-examine him, but I'm still left with, so where is the evidence from which we infer that Mr. Tarek was on the shoulder? And I'm just starting there. Like I said, you can go ahead and tell me why it doesn't matter that whether Mr. Tarek's on the shoulder. But I think your first argument, your first theory is that he's on the shoulder.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So help me out. If it's not Lang, who is it?
Trooper Rudenberg.
Pardon me?
Trooper Rudenberg.
So how did that turn out in Rudenberg's deposition for you? I mean, I have read these depositions, counsel. So I want to understand what you are drawing out of the depositions that I might be missing, because Rudenberg says he doesn't know where the footprints were in his deposition. Yeah.
Well, I think all of those exactly are the point. They see footprints. I think we have to peel back the layer of what they actually do know and do see, rather than what they perhaps maybe don't know. Right. I mean, a disputed facts is what they do know is they do see what appear to be footprints of a pedestrian on the shoulder. I do think that's accurate. They do see a set of footprints, which no one seems to match, of someone going into the roadway at some point. And that's, I guess, the disputed fact. And he says, well, there's also medical personnel. That's the disputed testimony on cross from, I was not plaintiff counsel. I think he could have done a better job, but you know, from that standpoint, but we have the record we have. But I certainly know that there's a suggestion on cross that he begins to, Lang falls apart of saying, I don't know whose footprints are whose by going out into the roadway. And I think we can add to that this disputed fact of if there are other footprints by their own testimony, both of, I think it's Adam Wood and Stephen Wood, that the body is moved. Well, if the question for me is, well, where are all of these footprints? I mean, we don't have a great record on that either. You know, are the footprints directly related to where the body was or on the shoulder? Presumably that's what we're talking about, since it appears to only have been moved once. And then we're left with, there's a variety of footprints.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Ross, did you?
I was just gonna ask, so if all of this is so, it seems to me, based upon what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's enough to cast doubt as to whether he was on the shoulder or the roadway, but I haven't heard you articulate a basis getting beyond a preponderance. If all we have is maybe the roadway, maybe the shoulder, Is there anything in the record that gets us beyond speculation that that he was on the shoulder?
My understanding is that his vehicle was parked. Why he's there at all is another question, right? Why is he in this location? That his vehicle was somehow quarter mile, I think, up the road on the shoulder, maybe had broken down, and that he was walking on the shoulder. So we see there were footprints, I can tell, farther back, walking on the shoulder down the roadway to wherever this accident exactly occurred. So I don't think there's any speculation on the part that at some point these
right, but I mean at the point of the collision, do you concede that what we have is enough for the jury to be uncertain, equally uncertain as to shoulder versus on the border versus on the shoulder or the roadway?
Well, I think all those questions are for the jury, right? I mean, the question isn't, it's whether
well,
or not.
In order to get to the jury, you have to have enough to prevail over some. In other words, enough in the record. If the jury believed the evidence, that the jury could believe by a preponderance of the evidence that the proposition that you're making. And if
right.
that's so, if that's required, what is there beyond the 50-50? Could be one, could be the other. We have no evidence either way.
Because all of his footprints were always on the shoulder. I think if we're starting with a fact of a person is walking consistent with the pattern that we have originally walking, right? He was never actually seen other than the point of impact, the suggestion of, I mean, this is the only unfortunate reality, which is that the driver is the only people alive to tell the story. So if that's the case, they say, well, that's where we hit him and he jumped out of nowhere and I'm not really sure, but we think he was in front. Well, again, where do I create the facts from? He's on the roadway, and then there appears to be an unclear statement by law enforcement to suggest there are footprints into the roadway. So I think if we start with the factual assumption, he has always been on the roadway because he was never seen in the roadway. He was always on the shoulder from where the footprints were. Then the inference was, yes, absolutely, he was always on the shoulder.
I think I get it. I'm not meaning to cut you off to be rude, but I want to make sure that you have a chance to address Judge Bradbull's second question, which is also my question, which is does it matter?
What do you mean? What does it matter?
Does it matter? Do we affirm if we agree that there is not enough evidence to show that he was on the roadway? Does that necessarily mean that the driver was not negligent?
Right. And I think the question is, I don't think this court can confirm, could affirm regardless. So I think if the point is he on the roadway or is he not? I couldn't find anything essentially either in Minnesota case law or Minnesota law that says essentially that a driver can strike a pedestrian in the roadway and not be at fault and never make it to a jury. Essentially to say that if a ball from the driveway, and I cite those other two cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court that had gone to trial, which is that if the court says, well, he may have been in the roadway, that's the assumption here. The court says, well, we're going to affirm because the district court thinks he's in the roadway. Again, I think that's a fact that the court should not have came to that conclusion. But again, does it matter? Is that I believe that's a sufficient question for the jury as to how much fault a jury applies by a person on the shoulder. I think we have to assume he's very close to the line based on the undisputed facts. He hits the very edge, I think, of the passenger side of the vehicle driving on that shoulder area. So, but by any accounts, either the vehicle went off the line on the right-hand side, struck him on the shoulder or on the line of the shoulder, or extremely close to that line. So then the question is,
you rely on the Catchman case, and there the Supreme Court was focused on the extra vigilance that a driver needed in light of the area. It doesn't seem as if this case is on all fours with that circumstance.
Well, I guess we should be thankful we don't have tons of people dying and appealing, right? We certainly never have a perfect fact pattern, right? I mean, all of these cases don't have perfect fact patterns, but I couldn't find a fact pattern to support the defendant's position or the district court's position, which is to say that a vehicle can strike a pedestrian and have, by as a, essentially a matter of law, that they get to make the claim they were in the roadway, I'm not at fault. And that doesn't make it to a jury. Absolutely never.
So,
I'm
counsel,
sorry, go
you
ahead.
don't mind. Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Smith, did you? I don't mean to take up all the time. Go ahead.
I did have a question. The part that I'm struggling with that I think the district court may have been struggling with too is can the lack of evidence get you past summary judgment? Because we have everybody agrees we don't know the point of impact. Like the troopers, the plaintiff's expert, nobody knows the point of impact. And so we have sort of the absence of evidence. Is that enough to get you to summary, to pass summary judgment?
Well, I would think absolutely. And I know Judge Ross seems to like criminal cases. I mean, every criminal vehicular hop operation type case, which is essentially akin to this, where a single driver says, and I think we even had that one, it might have even been the Silvernail case, or ones where circumstantial evidence, high speed, rain, you get into an accident, the person dies, and then the person ends up being on the shoulder or somewhere else. Well, certainly you go to a criminal trial. And if the probable cause standard, I mean, we make relations between the evidence and the amount of evidence you need to make it to a trial is very similar to that. And they always make it to trial. Otherwise, the defendant would always win, defense would win. And in this case, the defense would win simply because the state, AKA the plaintiff, wouldn't have enough evidence to suggest. So I'm sorry, I'm saying I'm out of time.
You are out of time. I'm wondering if the panel members have any other questions.
If you don't mind, Judge Ross, I'll just ask Mr. Burkholz, when you come back for rebuttal, if you would address the impact of Trooper Backer's reconstruction report saying that this is an unpreventable, I think that's the term he uses, unpreventable accident, but you don't need to do it now. You've got time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And also, if you could, when you come back from rebuttal, you can cite the authority that supports your proposition that, quote, Judge Ross likes criminal cases. That one. All right, counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Callie Gelberg Nelson on behalf of respondent Stephen Wood. I'll start with just first as a basic proposition that the appellant must rely on more than speculation to prove his negligence claims. And here we have appellant simply presents the mere possibility that Thurek was walking on the shoulder or walking on the shoulder, but his theory contradicts all the evidence in the case, and that includes respondent's testimony that he was driving along and he suddenly was met with a pedestrian in the roadway. We also have Adam Wood's testimony, the
Can I interrupt you there?
passenger. Sure.
I would like you to expound on those things, but can I have you begin with the other point, the other question, the second question that we're posing about to appellant's counsel, which is explain why that matters. Is it your position that a pedestrian who is struck on the roadway outside of a crosswalk cannot establish a claim of negligence?
Yeah, I mean, I do think I am concerned by appellant's theory that even if he's on the shoulder, there could be negligence because that creates an unreasonable standard here. Because in this
Roadway.
case, even driving on the shoulder, even with him on the shoulder being on the shoulder, that there would be negligence.
I mean, roadway.
I
You mean
mean,
if he's on the
that he's walking, that Thurek is walking on the shoulder.
So, counsel, if a driver hits a pedestrian on the shoulder, I think.
I did get confused. Okay, on the roadway, even on the roadway, because in this case we don't have high speed. Yes, it was snowy, but he was driving. The evidence on the record shows that he was driving from 43 to 50 miles per hour in a 65 mile per hour zone. Clearly, driving for the conditions, it's very dark. It's a 65 mile per hour roadway. You're not expecting a pedestrian to suddenly show up. And
Also, let me just, if you don't mind. So it's not that I think that your argument's not reasonable. That's a reasonable argument that the jury would certainly get to hear. Here's what I'm concerned with on summary judgment. we have to draw inferences favorable to the non-moving party, so to Mr. Duoth here. And it seems to me that hitting a pedestrian on a roadway at least allows a driver, even under the conditions you mentioned, driving correctly with road conditions and at a proper speed, but where there are things that, you know, even can be a combination of things that could be discussed about the driver's perhaps ability to either begin braking and slow down or to evade, you know, the pedestrian on the roadway, that there is a duty of due care, right? I mean, there is a statutory duty of due care for every driver, and that includes a proper lookout, right? So I'm just struggling with that argument that if Mr. Tarek was on the roadway, then the driver, there's, as a matter of law, the driver didn't breach that duty of due care. I mean, on summary judgment, like I said, totally get it in terms of a jury verdict, but on summary judgment, help me out.
Right. But I also think that there has to be some establishment that there's been a breach of that duty. And in this, in the case of speed, we've already established that the evidence on the record shows he was not speeding. He was going 43 to 50 miles per hour in a 65 mile per hour zone. Appellant doesn't necessarily present any speed at which it would have been reasonable, where he would have actually avoided the collision in any way.
Help you, though. I'm not sure that helps you. If you're saying, well, he was driving slowly, 43 miles per hour, that means the driver has more time to observe a pedestrian in front of the driver's car. So if that's the case, if you said the vehicle is moving slowly, is it 30 miles per hour, 20 miles per hour, wouldn't all of that at least allow for the argument that the driver, using due care, would have seen someone in front of his car and had opportunity to avoid the collision for the purposes of summary judgment only? Wouldn't that at least allow that argument?
Well, because we have Sergeant Backer's testimony that says that the collision, that he did not have enough distance and time, even at the speed he was traveling, to avoid the collision. It was not preventable. And I think that factors into...
Is that something a jury has to buy? I mean, if I'm driving a car and I know how... If an expert comes and says, you know, if there's someone standing in front of your car at 43 miles per hour, it's unavoidable. You have to hit that person. As a driver, I might say, you know, I don't buy that. I've driven a number of times. I've been on roads enough to know that something shows up in front of my car. I'm driving 40 miles per hour. I have plenty of time to slow or stop. That's the reason I've gone down to 40 miles per hour instead of going 50. Why must a juror accept that testimony?
Because I don't think it goes to the juror when there's no establishment that there's been a breach in the duty of care. Because the accident was not preventable, there's not a breach. There's no establishment that he did anything out to breach that duty of care of driving reasonably down the roadway.
Counsel, it would be a breach if the collision occurred on the shoulder, right?
Yeah, if he swerved off of the roadway, I think I would agree with that. But we have no evidence that he was actually on the shoulder. All the evidence points to the rake being on the roadway.
But there's testimony and in the reports, which I understand are not admissible, but you can use them to impeach, that talks about all the footprints leading from a car a half mile down the way up to this point where there's... and it matched the decedent's shoes. So why is that circumstantial evidence not enough to go to a jury to say, we don't know where he was?
Actually, I think that evidence you're citing to actually points to the footprints being on the roadway. What those individuals testified is that they saw footprints going from the car. Well, the trooper Rudenberg said he testified he observed footprints going from the car to the point of collision, which he identified as being in the middle of the roadway in that lane of traffic.
Counsel, if you don't mind, it's something that wasn't really discussed in the briefing, and I just want to make sure I get your take on it. So the troopers have some interesting different testimony about where the snow is, right? And the trooper that is, I think, identified as the one who actually followed the footprints is Rudenberg, but then Salto says that he also walked along. I'm not talking about depo testimony now. Salto says he also walked along. And Salto is pretty emphatic that the snow was on the shoulder and therefore he couldn't see footprints in the roadway because there wasn't snow on the roadway. Would you help me? Because again, summary judgment is all I'm worried about here, not a jury verdict. Jury verdict could agree with you. Absolutely, that Mr. Tarek was on the roadway and could make different decisions about where the snow was. But on summary judgment, it seems like we have to view that evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Duoth. And I just want to know how it impacts your argument.
Yeah, I think that when you have kind of what I view as a little more of overwhelming evidence to suggest that he was in the roadway and there were snow and footprints that they could observe in the lane of traffic, I think that kind of outweighs that. Not that the district court had to weigh the credibility, but certainly when you have, you know, probably seven or eight things pointing to him walking in the lane of traffic, that certainly no jury could reach any other conclusion.
But then we're weighing the evidence on summary judgment, right? If we have seven or eight things that say he's in the road and we have one thing that says he was on the shoulder, aren't we weighing the evidence on summary judgment?
I don't think that evidence about whether there was snow or not is indication that he was on the shoulder. I think it's just I guess it would be an issue of fact, but not an issue of material fact over whether there was snow on the roadway or not. And I don't think that just having Salto say there was snow just on the shoulder creates a genuine issue of material fact on that.
The district court seemed to rely significantly on Trooper Backer's statement or study, and the court said, and I'm quoting here from the district court's decision, based on Trooper Backer's study, he concluded that Mr. Tarek, and he's quoting from the trooper here, was walking on the roadway without consideration to the right-of-way of oncoming traffic. I guess if I were a plaintiff and this were a trial, I would make sure that Trooper Backer's cross-examined on the fact that he's getting into the mind of Mr. Tarek and deciding that he was on the roadway without consideration of the right-of-way, without any evidence as to why he was on the roadway, if in fact the evidence supported it. Might the jury be able to draw inferences of bias based upon what appears to be a characterization of what's in the decedent's state of mind, unknown to the trooper?
I mean, I think, again, that's quoting from the report and which probably wouldn't be admissible at trial. It'd be what Trooper Backer actually testified to.
But the district court, right. You're saying that the plaintiff wouldn't be able to cross-examine a bias based upon what the trooper put in the report? And more importantly here, didn't the district court expressly rely upon the statement?
Yeah, I mean, it does appear that the district court did. I guess when you look at all of the evidence, I guess what is the evidence to show that there was bias other than the statement that he that Tarek was not in consideration of the right of way? I guess the only reason I question whether it's really an evidence of bias is the consideration is not necessarily a state of mind as much as just not walking on the correct part of the road.
Argument. The trooper might be able to defend the statement that way, but isn't it subject to cross-examination? And wouldn't that allow a jury to call into doubt the conclusion that you're saying we have to rely upon to say that this doesn't even get to the jury?
Well, I think you couple Trooper Backer's testimony with all the other evidence, and it's just not bringing it past the mere possibility and speculation. There's no evidence pointing the other way. And that's what I think is fatal to appellant's claim.
But in that same report by Trooper Baxter, it talks about footprints on the shoulder near the location of the motor vehicle, quarter mile up, and the footprints match consistent with the footwear the decedent was wearing. And so that can be impeached during his testimony if he says, no, I didn't see any footprints. And it's like, well, here's your report. Read that again. Why isn't that enough?
That Trooper Backer? I'm sorry, did
you say that? Yeah, I'm looking at the State Patrol crash reconstruction report in the addendum. It's page 4 of Trooper Backer's report. And on the scene observations, it says footprints on shoulder, westbound Minnesota 23. And the footprints match the footwear the decedent was wearing. And so that appears to be some evidence, at least in his report, which is not admissible. But on cross-examination, you can impeach with the report. So why would that not be enough to survive summary judgment?
Well, he was cross-examined during his deposition, and that wasn't a point that was addressed. I mean, that was the opportunity for appellant to bring that issue forward during cross-examination. Trooper Backer was clear in his testimony that he believed that the Thurraic was in the traffic lane and not on the shoulder.
If we were to, well, what's the most on-point legal authority we would rely upon to conclude that even if he's on the roadway, there because he was on the roadway, because there's not enough evidence to show he was on the shoulder, that's sufficient to survive summary judgment, that there's not enough evidence to show negligence on the driver's part, simply being on the roadway?
Well, I think that we've got Arends versus Minneapolis Moline that talks about circumstantial evidence can be proven by can prove causation, but it must be based on more than just speculation and conjecture, and just presenting theories that are consistent with appellant's case are not enough to survive summary judgment. I think that's the district court best summarized it by saying providing contrary opinions without evidence is not sufficient to defeat summary judgment.
So if you just use math and calculate the speed that a vehicle is traveling at 43 miles per hour, how much distance you would have to not see someone on the roadway, the jury couldn't infer that the driver was negligent in not noticing. The driver could not have been watching the road, or the driver would have seen someone on the roadway. You're saying there's not enough evidence for a jury to reason that way?
No, the visibility study that was conducted points to the fact that it was not a preventable accident at that speed. He would not have been able to avoid it. And so I'm out of time. So for all these reasons, the district court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. And to appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
And again, just for the audio recording, if you could state your name as you begin.
Yes, this is Attorney Burkholz on rebuttal for the appellant Duwath plaintiff and Mr. Trek. So a couple key points. I think Judge Bradfield pointed out a point that I didn't focus on as much in my brief that supports the circumstantial evidence theory, including Judge Schmidt's point on the accident reconstruction and the footprints. But the photos from the accident reconstruction report, which would be admissible from the scene, show a roadway which appears to have very little white snow. I would suggest almost none. So that would heavily undercut the argument that there was any ability of the troopers to actually see any footprints in the roadway. And I just kept looking at all the photos now, and I'm not seeing even a hint of snow that would allow a full footprint, not even one, over the line. So I think that would cut heavily the argument that there's a suggestion, meaning there's a heavy enough traffic on this roadway to have cleaned the white snow. Now the shoulder all has white snow and the line and over, and you can see the tracks and you can see photos of emergency personnel, photos of people. But I think that highlights the fact that there's a significant argument for plaintiff to make that there are footprints and Tarek was always on the shoulder, and to suggest that the troopers saw some footprints into the roadway is speculative and certainly not disputed by any means. And the photos would again contradict that. Now, a couple of points. I don't want to miss my opportunity. Judge Ross, it's your dissenting opinion in the Helgett case. I wanted to appreciate your detailed thoughts as to the authority for your opinion, like you like criminal cases. So
what is I don't want to take you too much of your time on that frolic, but so what is the evidence in the record that could support a jury verdict of the jury finding of negligence if the plaintiff was in the roadway? You made the argument, well, you can't necessarily win. It's not a per se victory simply by if you could establish that there wasn't enough evidence to show he was on the shoulder. So then you would also have to present evidence to the jury to show that there was some form of reasonable care that wasn't met by the driver. And what is the evidence?
Well, I think the argument comes down to what is a common ordinary understanding that the jury gets to make. And I think that is looking, I know you asked for case law, the Gross versus Victoria Station Farms, 578 Northwest 2nd, 757, 1998 Supreme Court case, kind of, again, highlights that differentiation between ordinary negligence within the lay person versus the lack of expert testimony needed. And there's some other cases, but the argument then is the duty of care that every driver must operate, which troopers routinely cite, and that is such as snowy conditions, that if a driver goes into the ditch on snowy conditions, therefore they're not driving with the duty of care or driving too fast or too slow, even if driving under the speed limit.
But that didn't happen here. So in this case, what is the evidence of negligence, if assuming that the decedent was actually on the roadway?
The hitting pedestrian that you should have seen with their headlights. So pointing to the overdriving the headlights. And both the troopers seem to suggest that, and both in the accident reconstruction report, that there was sufficient time to see the pedestrian. Now, there's an ultimate argument, I think Judge Bradfield pointed out, that maybe I should comment on, that it was unavoidable. I think his entire report is heavily flawed because he uses Mr. Wood and is extremely biased. How can he use the person that was actually in the accident, who knows he hit a pedestrian, as the person to which he finds the basis of the distances being seen, including one of the outliers that he had 200 feet to see Mr. Turek? If he had 200 feet and the black box shows he didn't brake. So the evidence is zero braking, poor headlights, not using your brights when you should have, and hitting the pedestrian without using your brakes or any avoidance maneuvers. So all of those pieces of information, Judge Ross, would be sufficient to make it to a jury as to whether or not, even if in the roadway, that the driver's duty of due care should avoid people on the edge of the roadway. That's all I have. I'm out of time.
Thank you. And thank you to counsel. For your arguments, very helpful. For the record, I like civil cases as much as I like criminal cases. thank you for your argument. Thank you for your briefing. Tragic case, very sad ending. We will obviously address the matters on the basis of law and issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, give me a minute, please.